Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Neil Fasina in this episode. Neil is president of Athabasca University, following a career as an academic, including time as provost and vice president academic at the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology. Neil is also the current president of the International Council for Open and Distance Education. Neil and I talked via Skype. Well, it's my pleasure to be talking with Dr. Neil Fasina, president of Athabasca University and also president of the International Council for Distance Education. Neil has introduced a 5-year strategic plan, freely available online, to transform Athabasca University into a world-leading digital-first university. Neil, it's really good to be talking with you.
Mark, it's an absolute pleasure. Looking forward to it.
Can you give us a brief overview of your career and publications, just to start with?
I certainly can. If I take a look back over my career, it has most certainly been a series of doors that have opened to create opportunity for me to participate in some very cool things. But admittedly, it was not a structured plan. And what I mean by that is it just things began to emerge as I walked my path. And one might consider my start to be quite traditional. Finished an undergraduate and headed off to graduate school, and through the process of undertaking my PhD, had the goal and made that goal a reality to take on the role as an academic within a research-intensive university. Mm-hmm. And so followed that often familiar path of becoming an assistant professor and finding my way through the promotion and tenure process to become an associate and tenured professor at the University of Manitoba here in Canada. And about that time, I had a number of department heads in a short period of time, and at the time I thought, well, maybe I can take on a bit of a leadership role within the academy. And as I became a department head, it turns out that I really quite liked the administration side of the university. And so that led me into a series of next steps within my career, in that I went from a department head at a research-intensive university and became a dean of business at a polytechnic university, polytechnic college, I should say. And so a completely different environment than the one I was used to, but still nevertheless a very fun one. Through that process, it turns out started to undertake a leadership role in a series of transformations, and was appointed from Dean of Business to become the Provost and Vice President Academic in that environment. And ended up leading a number of transformations, which inherently found my way to Athabasca University when the university was looking for someone to take the helm as its president, to be able to return and transform the university into the global presence and value proposition that it is within the ODFL environment. And as a result, there was just an opportunity to be part of what is a very cool university that stands for an unbelievable mission. And the opportunity to be part of that was something I frankly just couldn't turn down. I believe too much in the mission and the value of the university on a global scale.
Fantastic. It sounds like a really logical career path until you point out that it wasn't something you had actually planned. So it all seems to have culminated in the role you have now.
It's interesting because the stars have aligned, but I got to tell you, when you think back to, career days in junior high school and high school, I couldn't tell you what a provost was, let alone know that I was going to eventually become one and only to then become a president, right? So, it's not a career path that most people imagine during their formative years, but it has been authentically the most rewarding career path I could have ever imagined.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, I think probably very high on your list at the moment will be the 5-year strategic plan for Athabasca University, the Imagine Transforming Lives, Transforming Communities document that's publicly available. Can you perhaps give a bit of an overview of that document and how it came about?
So back in 2016, early 2017, again, when I had arrived at Athabasca University, there was an inherent passion of all of the team members that was driving and wanting to drive towards creating a university that doesn't exist yet. And so as we developed that Imagine plan, what we ended up doing was, unlike other strategy building environments that I've been involved with, for the Imagine plan, we literally looked to the inside and all of the incredibly talented individuals that are part of Athabasca University. And we started the process with just a simple statement, and it was one that we asked members of our community to finish. And that statement was, imagine a university that. And that's where we stopped talking and started listening. And the creativity that came through the contributions of all the individual team members here at Athabasca were second to none. We had over 6,000 observations that we then ended up doing a bit of a discourse analysis on to be able to create the themes that you actually now see in the Imagine plan. And while originally there was 7 themes overall, it's not surprising that 3 of the themes that emerged were excellence in a teaching environment and learning environment, excellence in a research environment, and excellence in community service, which inherently are part of the university. And so those 3 themes into and of themselves don't necessarily make the university unique, but rather they're what we end up doing. More than that, it's how we get there. And that's where that Imagine plan emerged from. So it truly became a vision and permission document that honed in on what was uniquely Athabasca University and what we could uniquely bring to the global community of distributed learning, and how Athabasca University could take on that global leadership role, or one of among many of our excellent peers, to define what the university of the future looks like. And inherently within that document, you start to see the elements of what the university of the future looks like, whether or not it be creating learning opportunities that are accessible to literally anyone on the planet, but to be able to do so in a way that we can continue to say yes and never have to worry about disappointing someone by saying no. The ability to almost democratize the research environment to be able to accelerate global knowledge and be able to accelerate global innovation, whether or not it be social, environmental, or economic. And so it truly became this opportunity to band together as a tight, nimble team to say, let's build something that no one else has ever seen before. Because we've done it multiple times in our history, and it's about time we do it again. And so that was the energy that was inherent in that Imagine plan. And it's an incredibly aggressive plan in the fact that we're moving at you know, the proverbial lightning speed. But nevertheless, it was that document that said we have this ultimate global presence goal, and how are we going to achieve it?
Yeah, it's a hugely ambitious document. And I think what really impresses me is that it's not a supply-side document. It's very much a demand-centered, student-centered, learning-centered, education-centered document. It's interesting, that, as you say, that not other universities are picking up on this type of thing. How does online learning actually enable that sort of thing to come about?
Oh, so great question. And Mark, as you can probably appreciate, when I'm going to go back to that comment about never wanting to say no. I believe that some of the emergent technologies that we've seen over the last, you know, half dozen years or so are fundamentally enabling us to get to that actual point, right? So if we reflect back on, as an example, you know, sustainable development goal number 4, or the commoditization environment in which we're currently working when it comes to information, the passions for people to learn are everywhere. The potential behind human beings to reach their highest potential and to be able to elevate their communities, literally universally distributed around the world. What isn't universally distributed is the ability to participate in higher learning. And so when we look at that Imagine plan, if you know, if you were to ask me what is the end point of Imagine look like how do we know that we succeeded and can write home about it, is that we've created a learning environment that is authentically democratized to be accessible by anyone on the planet that has the passion to learn and that we're able to bring a learning environment to. And so online learning, while in its infancy was about reducing barriers in terms of flexibility, timing, schedules, and trying to meet the learner where they are, rather than asking the learner to come to us, the emergent technologies and online learning, kind of next gen, we can do that in a way that is ultimately scalable, that continues to meet the highest quality standards, that is reachable by anyone, anywhere, provided that they have a connectivity, whether or not it be a high bandwidth or a low bandwidth environment. The next generation of online learning allows us to tackle that ultimate access barrier.
Yeah. So some of the attention, no doubt, is on how staff teach using technology. But I'd imagine, too, there's a lot of systems work behind it. So, for example, making it possible for students to enroll at any time. That takes more than just changing how you teach. It's a fundamental shift to systems across the university. So it sounds as though you're taking that challenge on as well.
Indeed, and I'm going to take a half a step back if you're amenable, because I think what you're referring to is actually a phase that we're knee deep in, literally as of today, kind of thing. Yeah. But if I take a step back and I look at our digital campus, right? So we often, when we talk to our bricks and mortar colleagues, they talk about their physical space, their physical campus. In our case, we talk about our digital campus. Yeah. And in order to make our digital campus globally accessible, we needed to change the way that it was structured. So as an example, we are well down the path of a full migration into a cloud-based environment, right? So that computing power at multiple access points around the world just gives people that quick, immediate access to bandwidth, and it also helps us on our digital and cybersecurity side of things. But nevertheless, what it does is it changes that digital campus that, again, 10 years ago, we didn't have the option to do. That allows us the ability to create access, but it doesn't actually change inherently the learning experience. Mm. And so this is like one of the proudest things that I've ever been part of here at AU is actually the creation of a new learning framework, which is another one of those documents that we get out there and try to show the world that authentically puts the learner at the middle. And being able to create a learning experience that is just for that individual, that arrives just when they need it and comes at them in just enough, you know, information so that they can process at the rate that they need to, but is authentically allowing them to work with us to curate their own learning journey. Right, we're no longer forcing a curated learning journey on a learner, rather they're guiding it. We become the facilitator of that learning journey. So that changes our interaction with our learner. And then to your point and your question, in order to make sure that everything works between that new digital campus and that new learning experience, you're right. We fundamentally need to disrupt the way that our people, our processes, and our technologies inside of AU interact with each other. Mm. Because in order to reach that openness goal, whether or not it's, you know, locally here in Alberta or across the country in Canada or frankly around the world, we have to fundamentally change the processes that we use because it's a different learning experience. It's a different campus than we had even 2 and 3 years ago. So to take old systems and try to put them into a new environment, we're inherently trying to plug new technology into old ways, where in fact we need to create new ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm curious about the learning framework. So it basically enables a student to tailor their learning around their own interests, but of course, according to a particular framework. So it's still quality education in terms of overall outcomes. How do you actually scale that at the volumes of students that Athabasca must be dealing with?
Yeah, and you know, and so now you're inherently on what keeps me up at night. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's always going to be the need to have our human talent, right? Because, I mean, when a question like that comes forward, often people's mind will go to, okay, well, how do we bring technologies in that can do things to help us along the way, whether or not they be, you know, machine learning based or augmented intelligence based or things of that nature. And it's not that those don't exist and those don't come in to help scale. But really what we need to be able to do is plug those tools in into a learning environment where they are appropriate, and then be able to figure out how that those digital assets, whether or not they be the algorithm or the digital coaches and things of that nature, interact and work with, you know, the human talent that we have to be able to create that ultimate quality learning experience. Because as you noted, you know, one of our starting points is quality. That's the non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And so how do we create a scalable quality environment without having to draw on the traditional resource constraints of a publicly funded institution? Mm. And that is in part a function of having the learning technologies that are available today, and we're nearing a migration to a new integrated learning environment. But also going back to the comment I made earlier about how do our people and our processes interact with that technology to be able to do more with, you know, the talent that we have today. Because if we can do that, then we can actually start that scale-up process. But the ultimate limitation for me is the ability for the university itself to attract talent, right? And to bring the professoriate in, to bring the support systems in that we need to run that digital environment. Eventually we're going to get so big that I'm going to have a hard time attracting that talent. And so that's the 15-year out problem that keeps me up at night.
Yeah, I think it's really brilliant, though, the way you're considering online education, not just from that delivery standpoint. There's an all of organizational approach you're taking there, so that the new approaches sit comfortably within how the full university operates. And I think from my perspective, that's one thing that universities don't tend to pick up on, that they tend to leave the online learning stuff to the faculty, but their back office systems can't actually cope with the changes that are being requested. Yeah, you've got a broad smile on your face. Yeah.
I'm smiling because it's a fundamentally different operational model than a bricks and mortar environment. As you'll know, an online learner expects the ultimate online experience, which is fundamentally different than a digitized place-based experience.
Mm, mm.
Right. So to use your words, when you think about the bricks and mortar leaving the online to the faculty, but assuming that all the back office stuff stays the same. You know, that's like suggesting that, you know, the operational model of Amazon online ordering is the same as our bricks and mortar shopping malls.
Mm, mm.
And, you know, it's neither one of those two businesses would say that they're the same.
Yeah, yeah, true. Neil, it's now early 2020. Can we just take a bit of a time-stamped view of your observations about online learning and education as of today, thinking beyond Athabasca, perhaps more your impressions to do with the worldwide activities you see going on?
Sure. I think, you know, more than anything in today's environment, the global distributed / online / technology mediated learning space today is facing a couple of global pressures that we have a moral obligation to respond to. And part of that is that concept of scale. As of today, we have the bits and pieces of technology that will lead us to scale. But when I think about the global demand for higher learning and the number of new entrances entering the higher learning environment, assuming nothing else changed, is a monumental number.
Yeah.
And then when we look at the broader context that we're operating, so the societal changes, the technology changes, the inherent technological unemployment that is going to, like the wave of technological unemployment that's going to hit the broader economy, means that even beyond all else being equal, the demand for higher learning is frankly only going up. It's going to come from what we might consider today a quote unquote non-traditional learner, but arguably is actually a majority adult learner, and that is the adult that has commitments, that has financial burdens, that has family commitments, community commitments, a job and can't step away from everything just simply to engage in learning.
Yeah.
And so to be able to meet that demand is a staggering challenge. And that's, you know, sort of the inherent nervousness that you might hear in my voice is, you know, how quickly can we create that environment just simply to meet the demand that's going to be there in a quality space? So there, I think there's that one pressure. Another pressure is some of the pieces that interrelate to the ODFL environment and finding ways to actually integrate them, right? So as an example, we've seen a significant surge in research and development on open education. And, you know, early days, we talked about open being about access. And then the word open's been co-opted in many different environments, whether or not it be on the educational resources side, the pedagogy side, the curriculum side. That word open is becoming huge, right? Yet there's pressures to the institution where you're kind of stuck between the proverbial rock and a hard place. So, like, just to use an example, like the open educational resources environment fundamentally believe in the power of an open educational resource. Mm. And yet, you can see how the democratization of information is enabling us to get there. And yet, at the same time, every paper I read about the new economic models for open educational resources comes to a single shared conclusion, that we need a new economic model for open educational resources. And so right now, the sort of the state of practice is the recognition of the problem. We're not yet at the recognition of the solution.
Mm.
Right? So, you know, so I think we're at this bit of a precipice, not a bad one. I think it's actually a awesome challenge for open institutions. And then the last one would actually be around the concept that today, and I would argue well into the future, open, distributed, technology-mediated learning environments, we end up being the canary in the coal mine, if you will, right? So as there's new pressures in the learning environment, we're often the ones to feel them first. So if there's a technology need, you know, it's our learners that discover those needs and they tell us because they're, you know, keeping up with the technology companies. If there's a new pedagogy that enables learning that isn't a classroom-based pedagogy, we're the first ones to hear about it because it's something that we do. Okay. And yet the irony here is that despite the fact that we're the canary in the coal mine, today we're facing a global challenge as ODFL around convincing society of the utmost quality of online and technology mediated learning. For some reason, and I mean I can speculate that it actually has to do with the co-opting of the word open, because the, you know, the word open became free, which became low quality somehow. Completely false, but I can see the logic chain there for general society. But the irony here is that when you're doing open, technology-mediated, flexible learning, if you're not quality, you're going to fail all of your learners.
So the
starting point is quality, yet we seem to be challenged on a global scale by political and social pressures that suggest that we're not.
Yeah, there's an irony to that, isn't there? I mean, it's certainly here at Open Polytechnic, and when I was in the UK with the Open University, we still had to meet the same national quality criteria as every other university or institution, and yet still this myth about the relative impoverishment of open education still remains.
And it's such an odd irony to me. Now, granted, I think, you know, if we can rise to the challenge of the capacity and meeting the demand part, in the not so distant future, I think the political will and the social will come to realize that we're quality because we are the option. But, you know, in the meantime, it's not an easy challenge when you're trying to change the perceptions of society overall.
Yeah. Well, Neil, again, you've got a very privileged position as a president of a distance university and also as the president of ICDE. What research would you most like to see take place around the world at the moment?
So, and it's a great question, Mark, and I worry that my answer is not necessarily in line with what your listener might think, but nevertheless, it's my hopes and dreams. And that is actually around kind of that 10 and 15 year time horizon, right? Trying to recognize that once we've got some new stuff in place, how are we going to absolutely seize it? So I think it's clear from some of our conversation so far. I'd love to see research on organizational design to enable ODFL learning solutions right into the future. So that said, this is a today challenge. Right, I'm hoping that institutions like AU through trial will also discover some of those organizational design elements. Mm-hmm. But beyond that scalability side, I would love to start seeing the forecasting research around the interaction between algorithm and human, and how it. Yeah. How it plays out in a distributed and distance learning environment, right? And as you said, as the president of ICDE, we have incredible colleagues around the world that are everything from cutting edge technologies through to paper and pencil, because that's the technology that's available today. Mm. But as we start to face questions around, ethical AI, There's eventually questions that if you have a companion that's AI based somewhere in the future, we're going to be interacting with that. So what does the human have to know in that kind of an environment, and where do they get to rely on their companion? Who teaches the companion, right? So we tend to look at universities today or polytechs or colleges as the facilitator of learning for a human. Well, who's training the algorithms, right? And the concepts behind AI. I mean, we're going to have to start facing down some of these questions. As we start to embed some of these technologies, how do we maximize the learning experience, maximize the human interaction with some of these technologies, and how do we maximize the role of an institution to enable the human and their communities to reach their highest potential, given the presence of these technologies?
It's a major philosophical question. In fact, it reminded me at some stage of questions we had when I was going through the compulsory system here in New Zealand as to whether you should be allowed to use a calculator because it stops you from learning maths properly. So yeah. Whether your artificial assistant is actually doing the work for you seems to be a 21st century version of that problem.
No, and as you say that, Mark, in my early professor days, I was insulted when someone opened a newspaper in my classroom. Right? And you think back going, wow, if that was only my only distraction in a classroom now. You're right. But education evolves as we go forward. And as we start to think about even just the role of education, what does it mean 30 years from now? What does it mean 20 years from now? We've seen a change in the gold standard of what education is today, and we've seen that evolve since the modern birth of the modern university in the 18th, 17th century. Mm-hmm. Like it's not the same today as it was then, and arguably it's not going to be the same tomorrow as it is today, and we have to continually stare down those philosophical challenges.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you could take them quite far too. I mean, the whole epistemology and ontology of what it means to be human, what it means to know, I think they all come to the fore, don't they, in the sorts of questions you're asking there.
Yeah, and call my research interests in terms of what I would love to see others doing is to start, in the spirit of theoretical physics, where we might not be able to use it for 25 years, I think we owe it to ourselves to start thinking through the theoretical implications of where we can go with digital learning, and how do we ethically walk that line as a human being?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Neil, can we finish off then with two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you at the moment, and one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share?
So, I'm stuck narrowing it down to two, Mark. So, can I bend the rules a little bit and give you three?
That's fine. Thank you.
All right. So, the first one I'm going to suggest is actually from the educational side of things, and that's Dr. Liz Marr at the Open U. This woman is incredibly passionate about advanced learning on the distributed and technology-mediated side, and she is just a brilliant human being with awesome perspective. And so Liz, you know, every time I have a chance to chat with Liz, I am regrounded on what it means to be an educator. And so I would highly recommend Dr. Mark.
Yeah, absolutely.
From the operational side, there's actually two that I would suggest. And the first one is actually Simon Nelson at FutureLearn. And not because he's the CEO of FutureLearn, but because Simon comes from the non-academic world. Yeah. And when I have a conversation with Simon, it's brilliant conversation because we both have this ultimate vision for what's possible through digital learning, and yet at the same time we come from so fundamentally different backgrounds that Simon thinks, he challenges for me the interaction between, you know, championing an academic mission and running the social enterprise that is a university. I find that having those conversations with Simon are incredibly powerful. The other individual is Dr. Tiong from the Singapore University of Social Sciences, or SUS. This individual is, again, he's the leader of an institution, but he brings the willingness to every conversation to simply violate any assumption we might have when it comes to higher learning.
Excellent.
Right, and so when you have a chance to chat with them, it's authentic. Like you walk out of there going, "Wow, I never thought of the fact that I made that assumption," but he fundamentally challenges the way we think, and I mean, Seuss is all the better for him because he's that kind of a thinker. That's definitely one of those 10 and 15 year out kind of head spaces.
I think if there's a theme to this interview, it would be fundamentally change the way we think. You're certainly doing that with the Imagine Transforming Lives, Transforming Communities. It's evident very much in the passion behind your answers to the questions from the interview. So, Neil, thank you very much, and thank you for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure. Can't wait to chat again.
You can learn more about Neil and his work and find a link to the Imagine document mentioned in the interview from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.